The book of Daniel, a book of history and a book of prophecy, not evenly divided up. However, the first six chapters of Daniel do basically detail Daniel's history from the time he's a teenager until the time he's 90-some-odd years old. And then the book for the next six chapters goes back and then details the visions that Daniel received from the Lord throughout his lifetime. And so the timeline, we'll jump into the timeline in chapter one, but that the timeline will shift coming in chapter 7 and on through 12. We'll kind of have to backtrack and look back. But ultimately, in the third year, it says, of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Remember that Nebuchadnezzar visited Babylon, that city, Jerusalem. There you go. God calls it Babylon sometimes when he's angry, so I think that's okay. Came to Jerusalem on three separate occasions. We did detail this in our study of Jeremiah pretty thoroughly, but you know that the Babylonian captivity took place, and then the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem took place. I believe it was 9 years later. You can check those dates. And so in the exile, what we read, I think it was in 2 Kings 24, as a matter of fact. You know, I do so much better with notes, but you just can't read notes on Sunday nights because my contacts are all foggy. It says that at the end of chapter 24, it said that he led away into exile all Jerusalem, all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, all the craftsmen and the smiths. The Johnsons and the Greens were left behind, but the Smiths were taken into captivity. So none remained except the poorest people of the land. Well, as they were carted off in this captivity, certain guys were singled out. They were all of wealth or of talent. You know, only the poorest and kind of lowest class of society were actually left behind in Jerusalem. And those are the people to whom Jeremiah was having to minister to, if you remember that, and they still wouldn't listen to him. But it says that the king ordered the chief of his officials to bring in some of the sons of Israel, the guys, young guys, youths, mid-teens, early 20s kind of guys, in whom was no defect, who were good looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom. I guess I wouldn't have been elected, not at this point. No defect, good looking, intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered them to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And so these guys were going to be educated for 3 years in this, basically in this Babylonian schooling system. And at the end of 3 years, then if they basically passed all their tests and got through their midterms and everything and did well, they would enter the king's personal service. Now, among them, you know who these guys are, the four guys listed, but they don't sound initially familiar. You've got Daniel, who of course was Daniel, but you also have Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, who you think, who's that? Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know, the old thing, my three houses, my shack, your shack, and a bungalow. You remember that? These guys, these are their Hebrew names. When we say Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what we're talking about is the Babylonian idolatrous names. These names essentially are worshiping false gods. These names that they originally had in Hebrew were worshiping Yahweh, the one true God. So it says that the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. So to Daniel, he assigned the name Belteshazzar. And so in the book, we'll read him very often as Belteshazzar. So much easier to say Daniel. For some reason, instead of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, we say Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so that's what these guys were renamed. Daniel, it says in verse 8, made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. Now, I want to point something out to you by way of application and by way of encouragement. America has been equated and compared with Babylon a lot, and for justified reasons. I don't believe in prophecy, but I think just in parallels, in the corrupt idolatrous, sinful, immoral society that they were, although very intellectual, also very given over to the lusts of the flesh. America and Babylon, you would be justified in looking at in similar things. These guys are teenagers. And Daniel says, I'm not going to be corrupted by this. I'm not going to be, I've been thrust into this immoral, intellectual, but immoral world, but I'm not going to defile myself. A lot of times we just assume that teenagers, well, they're going to go sow their wild oats and they've just, you know, they've got to compromise. And a lot of times we justify a kid in rebellion as, well, you know, they're just working on their testimony, you know. You never heard that? We've made those excuses a lot. And yet Daniel has said, no, I'm not going to defile myself. It doesn't matter that I'm in the heart of Babylon. It doesn't matter that I'm in their school system being taught their stuff. It doesn't matter that I'm being tempted with all this wine and meat and all these things that they've sacrificed to idols and poured out as libations to idols. And it doesn't matter. I'm not going to do it. And so it was something that was definitely possible and still is today for a teenager or someone in their early 20s to be able to say, you know what? I'm not going to defile myself. Well, these four youths, it says in verse 17, God gave them knowledge and intelligence to every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Now, because it says Daniel understood visions and dreams, does not by definition mean that everybody who has the first or last name of Daniel understands visions and dreams. It happens to me a lot where people ask me, hey, I had this dream, what do you think it means? And I'll always approach it very seriously and try and be gracious and apply it biblically as much as I can, but I'm not gifted at this. To let you know, last night I had a dream, and this is not a joke. Last night I had a dream that I was desperately trying to get to the preview, the first run of a movie about the Dukes of Hazzard. And all these terrible things were happening to me. I'm looking at my watch and I'm saying, you know, oh, I'm going to miss the movie. And I only have $7 in my pocket and it keeps flying out and I'm losing all these things. And if I can't interpret that, maybe you shouldn't be asking me to interpret your dreams. I don't know. I'll give it my best shot. But I'm open to interpretations of that dream if you'd like to give a crack at that. I think it had to do with the fact that I read an article a couple days ago that they are making movies of old 70s shows like Starsky and Hutch and The $6 Million Man, I guess they're going to film, Dukes of Hazzard, all these kind of things. I think it was just in the back of my mind, combined with my paranoia of just being late and having no money. So I just didn't, maybe this Daniel thing, understanding dreams, is possible. So these four guys were presented before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king talked with them, and out of them at all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. Now, chapter 2 tells us that in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, you have to stop right there because a lot of Bible commentaries or liberal theologians, you know, we talk about them sometimes, have said, see, obvious contradiction in the Bible. These guys have been trained for 3 years, and yet how can it be the second year of Nebuchadnezzar if they've already been trained for 3 years? Ha, you know. Well, it's really clear from history that like Solomon did, you know, Solomon took over a lot of kingly duties before David died. Well, Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing. We see historically that for at least 2 years before, what was his name? Nabopolassar. I can never say his name. Nebi's dad. Before he died, Nebuchadnezzar had taken over kingly duties. At this point, he's been acting as king. He's been king for 2 years, but he's been acting as king for more than 4 years. And so it's not a problem with the timeline if you find a commentary that starts whining about that, pitch it in the trash. Nebuchadnezzar had dreams in the second year of his reign, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. The king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. Now, these magicians, conjurers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans, believe it or not, they're not four descriptions of the same thing. These are four different classes of what they would call wise men. This first word, magicians, comes from the Hebrew word engraving, to engrave. And so these were the guys that studied the ancient engraving, the studies of the occultic writings. And then that was the magicians. The conjurers were the necromancers, those that talked to the dead, those that channeled the dead, you know, the Jonathan Edward crossing over kind of guys, you know, the psychics that would say palm reading, those sort of things. Then there was the sorcerers. The sorcerers, by definition, you could call them Wiccans today. They were witches that would do potions and spells and those kind of things. And then the Chaldeans. Really, the Chaldeans refers to all the Babylonians. However, it became a class of people, the Chaldeans, meaning the wisest of the wise. These were learned, scientific kind of people. So if you think about it, they called in, Nebuchadnezzar called in the occultists and the scientists and the Wiccans and the college professors, you know, to this. And the king said, well, I had a dream and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. So they said, well, tell the dream and we'll declare the interpretation. And he says, well, no, I want you to tell me the dream so that I'll know when you give me the interpretation it's accurate. You know, it's kind of a trick. I mean, I could have done that. I had a dream last night. Tell me what it is. I'll give you a hint. It has to do with the Dukes of Hazzard. You know, there's this essentially qualifying stamp that I'll believe you can tell the interpretation if you can tell me what the dream was. And they said, nobody can do that. No king's ever demanded that of anybody. There's no way to do that. And he said, well, if you don't do that, I'm going to kill all of you. Okay, well, like we said, nobody can do that. Oh, you're just stalling for time. And he gave the command to kill all these brands of wise men in Babylon. Not the smartest thing to do if you're banking on wise men and you kill them all. But unfortunately, Daniel and his friends were being looked for to be killed as well because they were counted as the wise men, even though they hadn't been given a chance to interpret the dream. When Daniel gets news that these people are coming to kill them, he says, let me talk to the king. The king, here's what Daniel has to say. He says, you got to give us some time. I mean, you have to let us pray and find out. We'll give you the interpretation if we can. And so he did. He gave him time. Daniel went to his house and informed his friends in verse 17, and that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery. So they pray, and verse 19, it says, the mystery was then revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Again, don't ask me what a night vision is. I think it has something to do with these big binoculars that everything's in green. I'm not sure. If you look scripturally, sometimes night visions seem to be dreams, and sometimes they're differentiated scripturally from dreams. So if you ask me for a biblical interpretation of night visions, all I can say is, well, it seems to be a vision that happens at night. Okay? That's all the detail I can give you there. So they praise the Lord, you know, God of our fathers, we give thanks and praise because you've given Daniel wisdom and power, they pray. And so he goes to the king's presence and says, I will declare the interpretation of the king. Verse 27, Daniel said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. Notice this, that Daniel is about to be, he's been given this supernatural knowledge that could really elevate him to a place of high ranking. As soon as he tells Nebuchadnezzar what the dream was, Nebuchadnezzar is going to be like, you know, wow, this is the wisest guy. And he's in a position to be raised up to all kinds of power and authority, even beyond being a wise man of the Babylonian court. But Daniel doesn't say, King, I've figured it out. I've, you know, done some research and I've, you know, decided, and through my great intellect, he doesn't take any credit for this. He says, look, this is God who has revealed this. This is God who you need to give praise to because of this. He gives the credit to God. And that's something that in whatever abilities we have and whatever gifts God has given to us, we need to be really careful to be like Daniel. And that is to give God the credit. And if somebody says, whoa, you're just so gifted at this. You're such a wonderful singer or an artist or a musician or an administrator or, you know, a dancer or a runner or whatever. You need to make sure that it's like, well, thank you. I worked a long time on that. You know, instead saying, you know, God makes my heart beat and gives me breath in my lungs and I just give the glory to him. That's what Daniel's doing here. He's saying, look, this is not from me. This is from God. So he tells him this dream and says in verse 31 that in his dream, he's telling him, a king, you saw this single great statue, this huge statue. And he goes on to describe in verse 32 how the head of that statue was made of fine gold. Its breast and its arms were of silver. Its belly and its thighs were of bronze. Its legs were of iron, but its feet were partly iron and partly clay. And then he says, okay, so you saw this statue, and then you continued looking, and suddenly what happened was this stone that was cut out without hands, it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So then he goes on to describe to him the interpretation. This was the dream. This huge statue, head of gold, you know, and going on to silver and to bronze and to iron and then iron mixed with clay. And then this rock comes and smashes the feet, but then smashes the whole thing and it blows away like dust. Then he gives him the interpretation and says, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. Your kingdom, the Babylonian Empire, is this head of gold. But after you is going to arise a kingdom that is inferior to yours. You know, silver is inferior to gold. And so it's going to be inferior. And then another one of bronze will arise after that. And then ultimately the legs of iron will be a fourth kingdom. And then it describes that the feet and the toes were partly potter's clay and partly iron, saying that the toes indicate a divided kingdom. And so as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. I'm thinking of its feet, it's all strong. Whew. So, no, I'm just kidding. So, I made a heel of myself for that one. Sorry. You're making me feel defeated. We know historically that ultimately what happens is throughout history, there's been these four major kingdoms that were prophesied, that Babylon, the head of gold, was replaced by the Medo-Persian Empire, the Medes and the Persians basically forming an alliance and conquering most of the known earth. But after them came the Grecian Empire. These were the guys, none of them had gray hair, all of them jet black, the Grecian Empire. From Greece. And replaced by them was then the Roman Empire. And we see prophetically that the Roman Empire will arise again, although in a different sort of different form, a divided form in the future. This is what he saw. The stone cut without hands is the chief cornerstone. It's Jesus Christ, the rock. And comes and this rock smashes the toes, meaning at the end of time when this divided, basically, Roman Empire is destroyed by Jesus Christ. And then all of these which have remained, these other, because, I mean, let's face it, the Greeks are still around and the Persians are still around. And we call them Iranians. But then the Babylonians, we call those Iraqis, that they're all still around and they will even make it seems, into the millennial kingdom, but ultimately at the end of the thousand-year reign of Christ that's described near the end of the book of Revelation, these nations of the world rise up led by Satan and have this final last rebellion. You know, Satan's bound with a chain for 1,000 years, but then he's released for a short time. And all the nations, Gog and Magog, and all the nations of the world, they surround the camp of the holy ones. They basically come to Jerusalem and surround Christ and his followers. And he just wipes them out with fire from heaven. It's a pretty cool sight. And I've got video for $29.95 if you'd like to see it. It's a prophetic church. I've got it all on video. So this is essentially what he's describing, that this thing happened, and he describes this in pretty well detail. He describes saying that this stone, you know, that God's going to set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. So he goes on to say, in as much as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the king promoted Daniel, it says in verse 48. Interesting that this promotion was not because Daniel was self-seeking. He had given the glory to the Lord. If you're busy giving the glory to the Lord, the accolades that you receive are rightfully yours. If you don't give the glory to the Lord and you try and take them to yourself, then it seems like they end up getting taken away. So Daniel was promoted. He got a great many gifts, a company car, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And so Daniel made request to the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. So basically, while Daniel is doing the king's business, he has his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, doing his job that was appointed by the king. Well, chapter 3 shows us something interesting. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. He made a statue, interestingly enough, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. Now, if you calculate this out, the measurement of a cubit being from a man's elbow to the tip of his fingers, that's approximately 18 inches, a foot and a half. You work that out, we're talking 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide, this image of gold. And I wonder if he didn't make it look just like the image in his dream. Interesting, though, that he made the whole thing of gold. He didn't make gold and silver and bronze and iron and all that stuff. And I think that this was a really prideful statement on his part, basically saying, well, you know, dream shmeem, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm going to rule and reign forever. And so he sets it up that all the people in all of his kingdom have to come and worship this thing. He says at the dedication ceremony, anytime the band starts to play, you know, when you hear the opening notes to Purple Haze or something, you know, you gotta, when the band starts rocking and rolling, the band starts playing and it lists all these different things, the horn, the flute, the lyre, the psaltery, the bagpipe. Man, they're supposed to fall down on their face. If somebody blasted a bagpipe, I'd fall down on my face. Something, even Amazing Grace doesn't sound to me on a bagpipe. I don't know. It just, as soon as they start screaming, you know. Well, they're supposed to fall down and worship this golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Well, certain Chaldeans come forward and bring charges against the Jews. It's interesting, isn't it? As you read the scriptures, what's always happening? The Jews are always being accused because they're different. Because they don't do things the way the world does them, because they, for the most part, seem to follow the Lord's commands, whereas the world just does whatever they're told by anybody except God. And so the specific Jews, they said in verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration over the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They don't serve your gods or worship the golden image which you set up. Well, Nebuchadnezzar gets upset. He calls for these guys to come in, and they said, well, we're not doing it. And he said, well, you better do it. And they said, we're not doing it. And frankly, our God's able to deliver us. And even if he doesn't deliver us, let it be known to you, O king, that we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Interesting. These guys were 3 years in Babylon's public school system, and they're still making a stand. They're still making a stand for righteousness. They've been in Babylon for several years now, and they haven't been assimilated into the culture. Again, like Daniel made the commitment, so too these guys did, and they stood out. Well, they weren't going to stand outside for long because the penalty for this was to be thrown into a fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar was so upset by what they said. He had the furnace heated 7 times hotter and ordered these guys to throw them in. Well, it was so hot when the guys tried to throw them in, these guys burned to death. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are in this fiery furnace, but they're not falling down and burning to a crisp. They're walking around. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astounded and stood up in haste. He said to his high officials, "Was it not 3 men that we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" And they replied, "Yes." He said, "Well, look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." That's literally, as I recall, B'nai Elohim. You can translate that son of the gods or a son of God. I think that who they're saying is the son of God. So he sees this fourth one walking around in there. Says that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, and when they're let out, the hair of their head wasn't singed, nor were their trousers damaged, which is great, you know, because they had Levi jeans. And what else is a Jew going to wear but Levi jeans? Nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire come upon them. What a great thing. You know, when you after church tonight and you go hang out at Sherry's and they sit you next to the smoking section, wouldn't it be good to be so righteous that when you walked out of there, you didn't reek? Wouldn't that be cool? Well, these guys were in the midst of the fiery furnace. Talk about a smoking section. So they're in there. They get let out. Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, how do I describe this? This is a first in the Bible. This chapter was written by a Gentile king. This is his testimony. If you've ever sat and heard somebody's testimony, when somebody says, "Oh yeah, you know, I was born here and then I fell into sin and I became this and that, and then this guy preached the gospel to me and I got saved." This is what Nebuchadnezzar's doing. Chapter 4 is a letter that got sent out to his entire kingdom in all the languages of the kingdom. It's Nebuchadnezzar's testimony, a Gentile king's testimony. And so he says that he's writing this to all the people and the nations and men of every language. And he said, "It seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me." So he talks about another dream that he had. And in this dream, he saw this tree. And Daniel came and he told the dream to him that after the Chaldeans and the diviners and everybody couldn't figure it out, Daniel said, "Well, this is what it means. There was this tree, and it was this huge tree covering everybody. It was this massive tree. Well, then the tree, it was commanded that the tree be chopped down, and just the stump and the roots get left, and a band of iron and bronze was put around it. And then the tree started being talked about in the spirit world as a he, not an it." And it says that this tree let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. And he goes on to describe this stuff, and Daniel starts getting really worried. And says, "This is a bummer," and doesn't want to tell the king the dream. And the king says, "You know, you got to tell me what it is." "Well, the dream is about you. You see, you're the tree and you've grown up to be this huge, huge thing. But because of your pride and your sin, you're going to be chopped down. You're not going to be killed, but you're going to be cut down to a stump. The roots will be left so that you can be restored. But when you get chopped down, your brain is basically going to be replaced. You're going to have the mind of an animal, and for 7 periods of time, for 7 years, until you give glory to the Lord, you're going to be an animal. I mean, you're going to eat like an animal, you're going to live like an animal, and it's going to be a real bummer." Well, the king said, "Oh, okay." Daniel said that after you've recognize that it's heaven that rules, you know, your kingdom will be assured to you, it'll be restored to you. Well, Daniel says in verse 27 of chapter 4 that you know, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins by doing righteousness, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there may be a prolonging of your prosperity. Hey, king, repent so that this doesn't happen, or at least it's postponed. Well, 12 months later, Nebuchadnezzar is walking around on the roof and he's admiring this city of Babylon that he's built. Remember, they've conquered most of the known world and taken all the riches to their capital. And there's gold everywhere. One of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the Babylonian hanging gardens. He's checking this out. And just, he was so full of pride as he was walking around and says, behold, all that I have done. Look at everything that I've done. Well, immediately he gets talked to. And the word from the word of the vision was fulfilled. And he was driven away from mankind. And he began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers. I guess that's kind of like dreadlocks sort of thing. And his nails became like bird's claws. But he says in his testimony, verse 34, but at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. He says at the end of that chapter, he is able to humble those who walk in pride. Well, this has been historically documented by many of the writers through the excavations, the archaeological excavations of Babylon and things, that they've discovered this seven-year period where, although Nebuchadnezzar had pretty much every victory and everything that he'd ever done documented, and they found just tons of this stuff, there's a seven-year period where there's nothing documented, nothing that he accomplished. And many of the historians of that era write how there was, many of them mention a Babylonian king who went insane and all these different things. So essentially from 582 BC to 575 BC, this has been confirmed as happening in secular history and secular archaeology as well as biblically. So chapter 5 begins, 23 years has passed. Nebuchadnezzar is now long since gone. After giving his testimony, he's now not king anymore. Essentially his, what would he be? Stepdaughter's grandson. Basically his grandson, Belteshazzar. I'm sorry, not Belteshazzar, Belshazzar. Belshazzar. Anyway, Bel. The king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of 1,000. So this is now 23 years later, and there's a party going on in Babylon. Belshazzar tasted the wine, and he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, by the way, grandfather, that word can be any male ancestor. Father, grandfather, great, 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 great grandfather. So Nebuchadnezzar, essentially his grandfather, had taken these things out of the temple. And so he says, let's drink out of those. Completely sacrilegious, just totally, totally an abomination to God. So they're having this drinking party with this stuff that was holy and sanctified for use in the temple. And so while they're drinking the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And God's had enough of this. So suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. I like that description. That's pretty good. Well, nobody could read what this hand, this mysterious disconnected hand, had written on the wall. None of the, you know, again, they call for all the wise men. Nobody can figure it out. Well, the queen mother says, you know, something like this, similar, happened to Nebuchadnezzar, where he had something to figure out. He called Daniel. Well, Daniel's an old guy now, but they called Daniel, and he was summoned, and he would declare the interpretation. And he did in verse 25, he said, this is the inscription that was written out after rebuking Belshazzar, saying, you have exalted yourself above the Lord of heaven. You've grieved him by praising these false gods and stuff. And it reads this thing that's Mene, Mene, Tekel, Uperasin. Perasin. Doesn't matter. You don't know what it means anyway. Essentially, this interpretation meant God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. You've been weighed on the scales and have been found wanting or found deficient. Your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. This is the prophecy of when Babylon, the world power, would be replaced by the Medo-Persian Empire as a world power. And it happened that very night. Because that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. You can read about this historically. Cyrus, the king of Persia, knowing that there was 20 years of supplies in Babylon, there's no way to lay the city to siege, you know, to surround it and starve them out, you know, 20 years worth of supplies. So what they did is, realizing that the city was built over the river Euphrates, had some engineers and a bunch of guys go upstream and diverted it, build some canals, and diverted it to where the water of the Euphrates River went down to about thigh height. And so they just walked in under this wall that used to be covered by water, and they walked in, killed the king and the nobles. As a matter of fact, most people in the city, it was several days or a week before they even found out they'd been conquered. Because, you know, hey, what happened to the king? Well, he must still be asleep because of the drinking party. Well, no, he's been killed. He was killed last Wednesday, kind of thing. So Cyrus, the king of Persia, then gave Babylon to Darius the Mede, the king of Media. You know, he was like Ted Turner. And, some of them are just too obvious. So Darius has this whole new government to set up. There's 120 provinces in his district, essentially. So he sends up 120 satraps over these guys. Then he sets three guys, one of whom is Daniel, over these guys. They're the commissioners, and then he's the top of the pyramid. So he's there, Daniel and two other guys are here, and then there's 120 guys here, kind of levels of government. Well, Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Why not just make him the head of the pyramid so I don't have to do all this administrative stuff? Well, the commissioners, the other two guys, and the 120 guys, the satraps, they didn't like any of this and started looking for a way to accuse Daniel. Unfortunately, as they went through with a fine-tooth comb and went through everything he did administratively and business-wise and professional life, they couldn't find a single thing. I mean, they looked at his tax returns, you know, they saw if he was speeding in the company car. All that stuff, nothing. Nothing at all. And they realized the only thing we can accuse him of is if we make a way to where his diligence to obey his God and give glory to his God, if we can use that against him. So what they did is all 122 of them show up to Darius the Mede, the king, and says, all of your leadership has decided it's King's Appreciation Month. And so for the next 30 days, nobody in your kingdom should be allowed to pray to or worship any god other than you. And we all agree with this. So he said, oh, that sounds good. Where do I sign? Well, an interesting thing about the Medo-Persian Empire was, unlike the Babylonian Empire, where Nebuchadnezzar could make a law and then change it anytime he wanted to, the Medo-Persian Empire was run to where as soon as a law was signed, even the king who signed it couldn't change it. Now, you remember in the story of Esther, that became a problem, that you know, basically the king had signed a decree where, okay, you guys can kill all the Jews. Well, he couldn't. Bring that back. He couldn't say, okay, never mind, you know, ollie, oxen free, you know, kind of thing. So he's in a bind because Daniel, of course, knowing that this document was signed, still went and prayed. His roof chamber, he had his window open. He kept kneeling and praying and giving thanks to God three times a day, just like he'd been before. Well, they go and tell on him. The king, his hands are tied. The law is the law. He can't change it. The decree was you have to be thrown in the lion's den. And you say, oh, okay, I know this story now. Daniel in the lion's den. What you may not know of the story is the end of this, because your Sunday school teachers, when you were kids, probably never told you the end of the story. You know, of course, that Daniel got thrown in there, and the king didn't want it to happen, but he had to have it happen and said, your God will save you. And so he fasted all night and prayed, and didn't have the TV turned on. It said no entertainment was brought before him. And first thing in the morning, he runs out and says, Daniel, did your God save you? And Daniel said, yep, absolutely. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me. That's Daniel in the lion's den, the whole story, right? At least what you got when you were a kid. What they don't tell you on the flannel graph is what happens next. The king, and says in verse 24 of chapter 6, the king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them and their children and their wives into the lion's den, and they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. What a cool flannel graph that would have been. And here's the satraps, wife and children, you know. They stopped letting me teach Sunday school a few years ago. That's pretty much the end of Daniel's history of documentation from the time he's a young guy until the time he's an old guy. But then it goes back, and what happens in chapter 7 really is this vision that he got before chapter 5 happened, because it was the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, that this was the guy who saw the writing on the wall. It was before the writing on the wall in chapter 5. And he saw this dream, and essentially these four beasts arise out of the great sea. Now, some people say the great sea is the Gentile nations. My personal belief is the great sea is the Mediterranean, but it doesn't really matter. It's a vision. So out of the sea arises these four beasts. There's one that looks like a lion that has the wings of an eagle. The next one comes out and it looks kind of like a bear with these ribs in his teeth and eating a lot of meat. The next one is looking like a leopard with four wings on his back like a bird, and the beast has four heads. This fourth beast comes out, the fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. It had large iron teeth. It didn't even look like any animal he'd ever seen. And it had 10 horns, and he's looking at this thing, this beast with 10 horns, and another horn, a little one, comes up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots, yuck, before it, and behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. Long story short, because the vision is interpreted in the second half of chapter 7, essentially, these are the same four kingdoms that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. Babylon, as the head of gold, is the lion with the wings. And then the breasted arms of silver is the Medo-Persian Empire, which is represented here as a bear. And then belly and thighs of bronze, which was the Greek Empire, is represented by this leopard with wings and four heads. And then the fourth beast, which was represented by the legs of iron, and then the feet of iron mixed with clay with the 10 toes, all that stuff, is represented by this fourth beast. But some more details are given. Plus, these are represented as beasts, not as precious metals in an image. And the question you would ask is, why the reason for two visions? My personal shortened answer to that is, the statue made of these wonderful metals like gold and silver was from man's perspective. This is from God's perspective, given to Daniel, as all these conquering kingdoms, these empires, are described as ravenous beasts, and some of them are too horrible even really to describe because they're so brutal and malicious. Well, next what happens is the Ancient of Days takes his seat. Now, a lot of people mix this up with Jesus, but actually Jesus is going to show up. This is the Father sitting upon his judgment throne, and this fourth beast is slain, and his body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. Then it says, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. This is Christ coming. He came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So here is the Father being delighted to give his Son the inheritance of all the nations. As we looked at this morning in our study, the conquering king, this Messiah that the disciples were expecting. You remember this, that they didn't like the idea of the suffering servant Messiah. They liked the idea of the conquering king Messiah that's talked about in places like Isaiah 9 and Psalm 2, you know, ruling with a rod of iron, all these kind of things. So that's the description of that. So then the great beast, he has this interpreted for him by an angelic being that there's four kings will arise from the earth, but the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Well, then he says, I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast. This thing, you know, it was largely understandable in a sense that he could get all this stuff except the fourth beast. You know, so he says, what's the deal with this? What's the meaning of the 10 horns that are on the head and the other horn that comes up and does all these things? Well, the being says to him, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. So these represented by the 10 toes or by the 10 horns, they're going to arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. Well, if you're familiar, if you're a student of the book of Revelation, you see this identical thing happen where essentially this worldwide empire, which Bible scholars tend to call the revived Roman Empire, seems to be divided up into 10 basic areas. And now I don't know if that's going to be 10 kings over basically what was once the Roman Empire, going all the way from basically Western Europe on into Eastern Europe and down into Assyria and all these places and northern Iraq, or if this is actually a worldwide empire where 10 kings rise to power, where we don't have a president of the United States and the prime minister of Canada and Vicente Fox down in Mexico. We've got North American president, you know, all of North America. And then we've got a European president. And then we've got an African president and all these. However that works, I don't know. I haven't seen the future yet beyond this. These 10 kings, this other one will arise and exalt himself above these 10 and actually rip 3 of them out by the roots. And so this horn representing the Antichrist, that's one of the Antichrist titles in Bible commentaries, is the little horn of Daniel. We call him the Antichrist, we call him the son of perdition, we call him the little horn, all kinds of things. One of the things we notice is that this little horn has a mouth uttering great boasts. And it's hard to find descriptions of the Antichrist where it's not talking about him running off his big blasphemous mouth. He's always doing this. He's always uttering great boasts and blaspheming the Lord. And he's just, you know, I don't think we need to try and figure out the number of the name, the 666. You know, is it Ronald Wilson Reagan? There's 6 letters in each one of those. People thought Prince Charles was the Antichrist and all these things, strange things. Listen to the mouth. The mouth will tell you. Well, hopefully you won't be here, okay? that's a whole different issue. So, talking about the Antichrist and how he is going to speak out, it says in verse 25, against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. There will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Again, you realize that these descriptions of times in Revelation, it's revealed to be years, 3.5 years, and it's described in the number of days and in the number of months, and so it's real clear. The court will sit for judgment. His dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. So we see that happening, how he's cast into the lake of fire. 2 years later, it shows in chapter 8, another vision that Daniel had. This is 2 years later now. And he's in Shushan, which is the capital of the Persian Empire, whether he's actually in Shushan or his vision takes him there. And he sees this ram, which has 2 horns. One horn grows, and the next horn grows, and it's even bigger. And it's butting up against this, butting westward, northward, and southward. This is the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medes rose to power first, but the Persians became far more powerful, even though they arose after. So their horns are represented, or their empires are represented by the horns. And historically, we saw that they expanded in these 3 directions. Well, here comes a male goat coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. This is huge speed. This is amazing speed that this goat comes and has a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And as soon as, and so he butts him and wipes him out, hurls him to the ground, tramples him. Tramples, not Daniel, tramples the ram. As soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place came up four conspicuous horns. This goat is representing the Grecian Empire, the Greeks. The horn, Alexander the Great. That as soon as he was victorious, what happened? Alexander the Great, you remember, he was 32 years old. He sat down at the bank of the river and cried, wept like a baby, because there was no more kingdoms to conquer. He had conquered all of the world. Ended up, he turned to drinking, stayed out in a rainstorm, went home, fell asleep in wet clothes, and died. And his kingdom was divided between his four generals. And so we saw that represented by the leopard with four heads in the previous vision. And here the one horn is shattered and replaced by four horns. And so out of one of them, out of these four conspicuous horns, comes a small horn that grows exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the beautiful, or the beautiful land, which is Israel. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. If you're a student of the scriptures from Genesis to Revelation, you know the sun, the moon, and the stars represents Israel. We don't have time to get into that tonight, but it's pretty clear, especially from Genesis with Joseph's dream. And so this little horn, long story short, Antiochus Epiphanes, the guy who was so brutal to the Jews, he committed the abomination of desolation, rode a pig in to the temple grounds, to the Jewish temple, rode a pig, not kosher in the slightest, slaughtered the pig on the altar, smeared pig's blood all over inside the Holy of Holies, just horrible, horrible, abominable stuff. And so when Daniel asks, how long is this going to happen, or the Holy One, he hears this Holy One asking, they're told 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. It's interesting that if you look at this, when this happened, Antiochus Epiphanes committing the abomination of desolation in 171 BC, from the date, and this is a historical event that you can track down the date very easily, and you count 2,300 days, it takes you to December 25th. No, not Christmas, okay? This is before Christmas. You know what I'm saying. It's before Christmas happened. On December 25th, 165 BC, was the rededication of the temple. To the day, Daniel was completely accurate. We call that holiday that they commemorate this every year, Hanukkah. The Bible calls it the Feast of the Dedication. Jesus actually observed this feast. Remember, he went to the temple on the Feast of Dedication. So that all of these things, in chapter 9, Daniel shows that he's reading the writings of Jeremiah, and he realizes from reading Jeremiah 29 and Jeremiah 25 that the captivity, the Babylonian exile, the Babylonian captivity is supposed to be 70 years. Well, he's reading this in the 67th year of their captivity, and he realizes there's only 3 years to go, and the Jews can go home. So he prays this amazing prayer of repentance and goes down, you know, through this prayer in chapter 9 saying, we've sinned and we've committed iniquity and acted wickedly and rebelled and all these things, confessing his sin and the people's sin. And then Gabriel shows up. Gabriel brings this vision and says, this is the way Jewish history in the future is going to happen. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people. 69 weeks in this final week. The week doesn't mean week of days, like 7 days. A week in Hebrew can mean 7 minutes, 7 hours, 7 days. It works out to where it's groups of 7 years. 69 weeks of years until Messiah the Prince, and then he's going to be cut off, and then the final seven will happen, which is the last 7 years of Revelation. I know I'm abbreviating this. You're going to have to get the whole study in Daniel to really get this in detail. But he says, so you are to know and discern, and this is a command. You are to know and discern, it says in verse 25, that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Well, Artaxerxes gives this decree 93 years later, long after Daniel is dead. 93 years later, we read in Nehemiah, in the month of Nisan. It's different than the Toyota and the Honda, you know. In the month of Nisan, that same year, the same month that Passover is in 445 BC, he issues this decree. And if you calculate this out, that 69 weeks of years, 69 times 7 times years, and again, the prophetic year in Scripture is 360 days, not 365 and a quarter. It's 360 under the Babylonian system. You work that out to 69 times 7 times 360, and it takes you to 173,880 days. So that helps, right? You take that from Nisan in this 445 BC, and you count this out from March 14th, is what it works out on our calendar, up to 173,880 days. It takes you to April 6th, 32 AD, a day we call Palm Sunday. This works out exactly long after Daniel has died and widely distributed this scripture. We see, I mean, you know, thousands of years, or hundreds of years at this point, where Jesus entered Jerusalem riding on a donkey, just as the angel had prophesied on the day, in the same way that Zechariah said he would, humble and lowly and mounted on a donkey, and goes on to describe the actions of the Antichrist. Chapter 10 and 11. Describe, it's like reading a history book, if you're familiar with history, and we're not going to do it tonight, that as you describe this vision that he has given an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, if you know history, it reads like it was written after the fact. It's amazing to see the accuracy there. Well, by the time chapter 12 then rolls around, he is told that in the last days, there's going to be a real differentiation between righteousness and wickedness. And ultimately, it says in chapter 12, verse 3, those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of time. Many will go back and forth, and knowledge will increase. It says in verse 10, many will be purged, purified and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand. Well, if you didn't understand a lot of this tonight, don't think that you're wicked, okay? We went through this very fast, but I do commend to you so that you know and discern to a more lengthy study of the book of Daniel. You won't understand the book of Revelation without it. And so if you're getting into a study of Revelation, make sure you understand Daniel. We've got tapes, we've got the notes on the internet. There's lots of good commentaries on this that go into far more detail than we've gone into tonight. But what the Lord would remind us tonight is that many are going to be refined in these days. And let's go to him in prayer regarding that.